So every year since I've been the minister here, now for, I think 11 times, at every year at the auction, one of the things that is up for auction is one of my sermons called You Pick a Sermon. And I do this for a few reasons. One is to raise money. Another one is to have fun. Another is to see how much you think my sermons are worth. And they've gone up and down over the bidding process over the years. But actually, one of the most important reasons, frankly, is that what it allows me to do is it gives me the opportunity to hear about the things that are important to you and to come engage with me about the things that will speak to you in worship. In some traditions, a sacred text like the Bible is the place that ministers and congregations go to week after week to help inform their religious path. But part of this exercise is about reminding you and reminding me that the place that we go to is really to each other and the path of life. Because, my friends, you are my lectionary. Liturgy means work of the people, and we together form the liturgy of this church. So it's great that today I get to make that experience explicit, because Molly, actually her husband Peter, at the auction last year, bid on this item. Remember, she like batted him, like, "What are you doing? Don't do that." So anyway, Molly and I sat down a few weeks ago in Natick at the coffee shop to talk about today's topic. So Molly, why don't you tell us what today's theme is?
Today's theme is apology. I asked Nathan to talk about I'm saying I'm sorry because I think the world needs more apologies. An apology is a humble but courageous act that almost always improves a situation. Anyone can make an apology, but most of us are really bad at doing it. Also, I think Unitarian Universalism can help us become better apologizers. What we do with our mistakes and flaws is one of the quieter, darker aspects of religious life. Some religions have rituals like confession or occasions like Yom Kippur, but our tradition doesn't make a place for this kind of reckoning. As a psychologist, my office is a sort of secular confessional. I hear from many people how much and for how long it hurts when they've made a big mistake or hurt someone badly. I personally also feel a deep soul need to make things right when I've made them wrong. We all know that everyone makes mistakes. Everyone falls short, is imperfect, shoots their arrows wide of the intended mark. Sometimes in relation to another person, but more often, I think, in contrast to our fondest wishes of who we hope we can be. We don't live up to our own standards. That missing the mark is the original meaning of the Hebrew word for sin, which I know is not a popular word around here. So I'm going to use it in quotes, but that's my definition of sin, too, when I'm not my truest, best self. When I've sinned, according to that definition, how can I make peace with myself? Unitarian Universalism doesn't have a very well-developed concept of sin, but I wonder if we can find the possibility for redemption anyway. In Annie Lamott's book, which Nathan has referred to many times, she says the only prayers are thanks, help, and wow. But to that list, I would add, I'm sorry. In our tradition, we learn that we are loved and accepted, which I highly value. I just think there's another missing step, a mechanism for repentance, for replacing wrongdoing with right-making. I believe we can do more to meet the nearly universal need to apologize or confess. I think we tend, instead, to hide our shameful flaws from each other, wishfully pretending we weren't imperfect. I'm asking this morning, how can our beloved community help us face more bravely those times we're not all we want to be, when we need to make an apology to someone else, to our better selves, or for those who think that way, to God?
So when Molly first brought this topic to me, I was like so grateful to her because really she lets me off the hook for having to talk about the S word. One of the amazing things about this sanctuary that you might notice is how revealing it is for our faces. And there's times in the pulpit I can look out and I can see the joy on your face, I can see the sadness, and I can also see you wince at times. And one word that time and again makes you wince is that sin word. And I think because religion and clergy have such a long, illustrious career with making you not only wince, but feel guilty, right? Now, I happen to think that guilt is not a very bad thing at all. It's kind of like, for me, the internal alarm that goes off. And when we go off course, it rings really loudly. But it's also true that for some of us, and especially given our religious backgrounds, that the guilt alarm or the sin alarm, it rings like really loudly and maybe too often. We kind of want to hit the snooze button, right, when we go to church. Thank you enough, I've heard that already. Leaving some of us to feel beaten up or defensive, or worse, not worthy of love, not worthy of someone else's love, or maybe even not worthy of God's love. Now, our Unitarian Universalist tradition, of course, was founded on a balance to that experience of feeling guilty. Especially, you might have heard the sermon by Jonathan Edwards, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. People would rush to hear the sermon, and you're thinking, why? Because they knew that if they didn't go to that sermon, maybe they'd be doomed to hell. So they had to hear the sermon to be converted. And the sermon said that only some people were saved, and only some people were worthy of grace. And in fact, the mantra of Unitarian Universalism back in the day was the following. The Unitarians believed that they were too good to be damned, and the Universalists believed that God was too good to damn them. So even then, our humility was strong, right? But the legacy of this important corrective that we've offered against this feeling that not all of us are worthy of grace is what I think Molly is noticing. And it means that we don't have an established religious practice of dealing with the ways that we fall short, we miss the mark, we aim and we go way to the left or way to the right. The ways that we sin. And it leaves us many times to wonder how to make amends. And it drives folks to Molly's office for a secular confessional. So really, I joked with her, our tradition is helping to improve her business.
My favorite UU principle asserts the worth and dignity of every person. In my life, there have been times when I felt as if I crawled barely, gratefully, into the circle of worthwhile people here in this church. I need to be part of a community where each of us is valuable. I admire the way universalism turned away from the Calvinist-flavored judgment toward universal salvation, basically because I can't imagine a world where eternal damnation makes any moral sense. But I feel sometimes like there's been a sort of forgiveness inflation where lip service to forgiveness passes for a deeper, realer reckoning. When I was a Catholic child, I remember deciding to do something bad, like use swear words at my brother or something, even though I would have to confess it on Saturday. Our UU tenet of universal salvation sometimes seems like that, as if it doesn't matter what we do. It's a sort of get-out-of-hell-free card. Even if our failings don't matter in the ultimate salvation sense, that is, we will be held in love no matter what, I still think they matter in the meantime, in our most human moments. In my experience, good people feel bad when they do bad things. That's good guilt. It's one of the ways we know we're good people. It can drive us toward that most important human activity, repair.
So I also joked with Molly that, you know, when you get ordained, this is the coolest thing, you get a stack of get out of hell free cards that you have to distribute sparingly. So I'm happy to give you one after the service. Okay. Now, I agree, actually, with Molly that we have sort of a soft and flabby approach to the what Martin Luther King described as the human propensity to take the low road. And Molly was very surprised, and you may be too, to hear the following. Did you know that MLK, when he was getting his PhD at Boston University, my alma mater, considered for a time the Unitarian ministry? And do you know why he decided against that path? He decided against that path because we, as a tradition, did not have a well-developed sense of sin, and therefore would not be able to deal honestly and appropriately with the sin of slavery. Surprising, isn't it? And it's disappointing. So what do we need to do differently? I sometimes think that, you know, we have this, like, we have the welcome flag outside, which is an important welcome to our gay and lesbian friends and our transgendered friends to come into this church. So we have a welcome sign, but I sometimes think that it ought to be replaced with, and this is where the sermon title comes from, no perfect people permitted on the premises. Because we have such a beautiful facade, and this church is like right out of central casting, and it's like a postcard perfect image of what a church is supposed to look like. We have in this church, we live in one of the highest priced zip codes in the state, if not even the country. And I sometimes think that all of that perfect message sends a message that we don't want people to hear, which is that you have to have enough money to be here. You have to have everything going well in your life to be here. You have to have either never committed a mistake or have hidden it so well that no one will ever notice. You will have never had to tell anybody in church that you have missed the mark. I know that in my time here, an usher has never approached anyone in the pew and said, like that homeless man we heard about from the youth trip, talked to him, he said, you know, you can't be here because you don't look right, you don't smell right. I know that's never happened here, but I do wonder sometimes if someone who has come into this space and looking at all the people around them and thinking, you know what, everybody looks so good, so happy, so redeemed, that maybe I don't belong, and they've slunk out the back.
We all make so many mistakes, many of which have no consequence. They barely leave a ripple. In her hilarious, disturbing book, Being Wrong, Adventures in the Margin of Error, Catherine Schultz presents research about how frequently and how flagrantly wrong we are, as well as how incredibly bad we are at detecting our errors. It's a really good read. In our broader culture, public responses to mistakes or wrongdoing veer from easy, cheap pseudo-forgiveness on the one hand to vitriolic, whole-hog condemnation on the other. Our airwaves are full of hyperbolic argument between the two extremes. What I believe we need is a more balanced approach, what I'm calling compassionate accountability. Our beloved community, with its careful, nuanced voice, should be a good counterpoint to the bombast around us. Can this church help us figure out which of our sins matter and what we can do about them? Some religions provide seasonal opportunities to reflect on our lives, to improve the aim of our arrows. Maybe we can find something like that here during Lent, the current Christian season, which I know may not have much theological meaning to most people here. But could this be an opportunity for considering those times when our arrows inevitably fly wide and we land ourselves in a world of regret?
So like you, I know that one of the gifts that you find in our tradition is that it asks us to be open to the gifts and the wisdom of the world's religions, right? And this doesn't mean, of course, being only open to the parts of the traditions that we happen to like. Like, oh, I love meditating, so I'm kind of like a Buddhist. And I love going to seders, so I'm kind of Jewish here. Like we're like going through a deli tray or something, like I'm picking out the favorite parts of other religions that we want to eat from. The problem with that approach is that we don't take the things that maybe don't make us feel as happy as we want to feel. The season of Lent, I think, is one season that we can learn from because it asks participants to spend 40 days reflecting on the choices that we've made, what we love and what we don't, what we choose to worship in life and what we don't, who we've harmed, and how we can make amends. So not for nothing does the season of Lent begin with ashes on the forehead. You might have seen this, of course, just a couple weeks ago, reminding us, this is done to remind us that we come from the earth and we return to the earth, that our lives are short and they're fragile, so we had better use our time well. And when we do things well and right to lift those up, and we do things wrong and hurt others to seek forgiveness. I remember confessing to Molly over coffee that I often wonder sometimes, I agonize really, over what I can do as your minister differently in our shared worship to help us go deeper in this area of forgiveness and apology and sin, rather than simply giving lip service to a little prayer here or a sermon over there. But I'm also keenly aware, as I told Molly, that going deeper in those areas would be very hard for not just a few of you. Because some of you have allergies to the Christian perspective, and some of you have allergies to the Jewish perspective. And that makes it hard for you, and therefore hard for me, to enter into these places fully without feeling defensive. So I'm wondering, Molly, what you have learned in your practice as a therapist and a psychologist to help us reckon more fully in this way. We're not, you know, we're oh so not perfect people.
Most of what I know about good apologies, I've learned from the couples I've worked with clinically over the past 30 plus years. I believe a good apology has to include the following four steps.
So take notes. Ready?
Number one, the apologizer acknowledges his or her error, including its effect on the other person. Sounds simple, but this is no small feat for most of us, especially when we didn't intend to hurt someone. Let me repeat, even if I don't mean to, even if I am loath to think of myself as someone who causes harm, I can still hurt or even harm someone else, even if by mistake. Number two, the penitent must state his or her regret convincingly. This is why the magic words solution, I'm sorry, doesn't work. This is why I don't recommend rote acts of contrition or penance. Number three, the apologizer makes reparations. This can be material restitution, the legal concept of making the other party whole, although in relationships it's more likely to fall into the realm of makeup, do-over offers, such as, I will be the one to make sure we make it to your family's reunion in June, happily.
Happily.
Happily. Number four, the person who's apologized makes a plan to prevent the problem from recurring. For example, I'll meet with a therapist to figure out why I'm always so dense about your family. Nathan, is there a theological way to frame these steps toward repair, a UU version of apology or confession rituals?
And Molly had taken a line out there that says, I don't recommend rote acts of contrition and penance, by the way. And she's right, really, because those rote acts of contrition don't seem sincere, do they, sometimes? Unless, of course, we're sincere about them. So I can't pretend, despite all my years of training and all my years of ministry with you, to know how to create a practice that covers all of these bases, but I do think I can help us start. So I want to know, will you try something with me? That was kind of like very lukewarm. Yes, right? Okay. I'm not going to ask us to get on our knees, by the way, just so you know. So Molly, will you try something with me too? So I want you to repeat after me. I, say your name, am a non-perfect person. I want you to say that again, actually, to make it clear. I'm a perfect person. And now I just want you to listen. And as a non-perfect person, I miss the mark. Okay. Now just do this exercise with me. I want you to think of a time or a person that you have harmed, however unintended, and I want you to call their name silently to mind. I want you to think of their face and their name. And I want you to ask yourself, what do I most regret in my relationship or my interaction with this person? Is there one thing that I could undo? And if so, what would it be? Next, I want us to think about one thing that you can try to do this week that could help repair what has been broken. Just one thing. And I want us to notice this is an action and not simply words. Finally, I want us to reflect on what you might need to do differently to keep this hurt from happening again. Do you need to talk with one of your ministers here? Do you need to see a therapist? Do you need to take an anger management class? Do you need to find time for quiet every morning? Friends, the beginning of every church year in September, you know, the first Sunday we come back, I ask us to collect water, and the request I'm going to have for next year is to have it come from a sacred space for you. This water really is our version of holy water. I use it to bless our babies, and this is because water really is the source of life. It's a cleansing, purifying thing, and we cannot live without it. And so here at the end, I asked Molly if I might try something with her, to take some of this water that I have in the bowl and to place it in the palm of her hand, helping her and all of us to remember that we come to this place in this house every week to be refreshed and to be made whole and to be forgiven and to forgive despite our failures, despite our misses, despite our flaws.